Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we'll be talking with internationally renowned expert physician and chief of the Division of Pediatric Blood and Marrow Transplantation at Duke University, Dr. Joanne Kurtzberg, about the gift of cord blood donation.
You know, Christy, this is a topic that I think I wanted to learn more about, and I know that our listeners are going to be really fascinated with it. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
I am too, but first we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about pesticides and a link with Alzheimer's disease.
About excess weight, obesity, and seatbelt use.
About third-hand smoke being just as deadly as first-hand smoke.
And then we're going to find out what occupations make you less likely or more likely to be overweight. There could be a few surprises.
Let's talk first about pesticides. So this was a study published in JAMA Neurology about looking at a link of pesticides in there, how pesticides break down in your blood. It goes from DDT, which is a chemical used in pesticides that was banned in our country in 1972, but can stay in your blood for a long time. And that breaks down into something called DDE that you can measure in the blood over time.
And in this particular study, they looked at the amount of DDE, that metabolite, that breakdown product of DDT, which no one wants. They looked at it in the group of 86 people in Alzheimer's group and compared that to a group of 79 people who didn't have Alzheimer's, and they found that that pesticide was four times higher in the Alzheimer's group.
And so from this research, you can't conclude that this DDT exposure is responsible for getting Alzheimer's disease, but it does say that if you have higher levels of this metabolite in your body, and almost everybody has some in their body, if you have higher levels, you are more likely to be diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. We need to understand this more fully, I think.
I think this is one reason that some people might actually choose to try to go with organic produce and meats and vegetables if they wanted to actually do something to limit their exposure, because most of the exposure would come from things that you would get from products overseas.
Exactly.
And that products, if they were organic, you would not have this exposure, presumably. Though it's preliminary, we can't really make too much of this, but we note it.
Yeah, we do. Let's talk about noting using your seatbelt and following the law. So this is a study looking at a link between obesity, seatbelt use, and your likelihood to die from a car crash.
You know, Christy, I remember someone who helped take care of me and get me to places when I was younger and a babysitter, and she was 325 pounds. And I remember so vividly that not only was it difficult getting in and out of the car, she could never put her seatbelt on because the seatbelt wasn't large enough. They didn't make them large enough. Now, we do have some adjustments that can be made, but we know it's very difficult, and not all cars really are equipped with these.
It's true. So we know that an earlier study found that people who were considered morbidly obese were 56% more likely to die in a car crash than people who were of normal weight. And this study was an analysis of a big database of nearly 200,000 fatal passenger car crashes. And they found that normal weight Americans involved in these accidents were 66% more likely to have been wearing a seatbelt than those who were severely obese, which explains the former study's results.
Well, and it is what's called a dose response. Unfortunately, it's the wrong direction here. The higher the weight, the more likely these crashes were going to be fatal and deadly. And so those who were just slightly obese were 39% more likely, and those who were morbidly obese were 23% more likely. And so the more you have weight, the worse these outcomes are, the less you're likely to buckle up. This was published in the American Journal of Emergency Medicine, and there's a lot of take-homes here. One is that we need to make sure that no matter your weight, that you do buckle up.
Yeah, important to buckle up, important to get a car that you can sit in comfortably and wear your seatbelt, and to make whatever adjustments you need to in that car to be able to wear it consistently.
Yeah, and also we have to work on weight loss, but that's a longer-term solution. We have immediate short-term things. Speaking of short-term things, Christy, this next research on third-hand smoke, we've talked about it on the show a couple times, and we've shared some research that suggests this is something to be worried about, that residue from someone who's using tobacco products, cigarettes, and one can smell it on their clothes when they are walking past you. When you walk into the home, one can kind of smell it. That's that third-hand smoke, that exposure to the residue of cigarettes.
Yeah, it's so important. When we say first-hand smoke, that's the smoke you breathe in when you smoke. Second-hand smoke, that's the smoke you breathe in when somebody else is smoking around you or there's a cigarette around. Third-hand smoke is exactly what you're talking about, Adam. The stuff that's kind of left, that you can smell it. I mean, it's left around in the car, in the couch, on people's clothes. And this is really looking to see in mice what happens just from the effects of that third-hand smoke alone in the body.
And this was really kind of frightening because we know that a lot of our understanding of what happens with human health really comes from animal studies. And this particular study that was published in PLOS ONE, they found that mice that were exposed had alterations, changes in many organ systems in their body, with changes that were very similar to when they're exposed to regular smoking, such as having higher levels of cancer-causing tobacco-related chemicals in their urine and in their organs.
We know that third-hand smoke has strong carcinogens, or those things that cause cancer. But this is showing that even specifically in the different organs, that
like the liver,
the liver, the lungs, wound healing, that the effects on the body of for these mice was the same as what we see, and very similar to what we see in people who are smokers in humans. So
take home message, if you are a tobacco user, we want you to quit. If you're a smoker, we want you to get in to help and quit. And recognize that that residue in your car, in your homes, and on your clothes is also toxic. And so others that can be exposed to it, you need to eliminate it in your home, in your car. And really, let's all work towards a smoke-free society.
That's right. Now, let's talk about jobs. Did you know that your job can be related to your likeliness of being overweight?
Well, I didn't really think about this a lot, Christine. I'm not sure I'll think about it a lot after we get done, but you know, there is research here and it's kind of interesting. It was in Preventing Chronic Disease, and the top 10 jobs that have the highest rate of obesity and the top 10 jobs with the lowest rate of obesity.
And well, so, you know, I think it's good to kind of check out where your job falls on this scale, mostly to think about if you're in a job that's very sedentary, you need to find ways to get your body moving outside of work.
We truck drivers and those that were in the transportation and material moving industry, over a third had a risk of obesity.
And other things of cleaning and building services, if you were a mechanic or a repairer, or technicians, plant operators, or just administrative support, those also are jobs that have the highest obesity risk.
Not unexpected, Christy. Doctors have a very low rate of obesity, as do most other health professions. But even groups like construction actually had a much lower rate of obesity, almost twice as less as those like as truck drivers. At the construction workers, a rate of obesity of 20%. That's still too high, but much less.
And that makes sense that the construction workers are moving their body and sort of exercising at work. I was surprised that food preparation and food service was also in this thing of lower obesity risk. Maybe because if you're a waitress, you're walking around and moving. I don't know.
The one I found most fascinating was the math and computer scientists. They had a lower rate. Maybe they're exercising their mind so much.
I don't know.
That'll conclude the research that matters. We have a nice chance to really talk about third-hand smoke and about obesity and driving and seatbelts.
And about a link between a pesticide chemical, DDT, and Alzheimer's disease. That'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of the show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with internationally renowned expert, physician, and chief of the Division of Pediatric Blood and Marrow Transplant at Duke University, Dr. Joanne Kurtzberg, about the gift of cord blood donation. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with internationally renowned expert, physician, and chief of the Division of Pediatric Blood and Marrow Transplantation at Duke University, Dr. Joanne Kurtzberg, about the gift of cord blood donation.
Thanks for being with us, Dr. Kurtzberg.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, tell us how you became passionate about cord blood donation. Everybody's got a story or something that piqued their interest, and we'd love to know how this became your passion.
Well, you know, the story of cord blood, both transplantation and donation, is owned by North Carolina. So back in the mid-80s, I was taking care of a little boy with Fanconi anemia from Salisbury, North Carolina. And Salisbury, Fanconi is a genetic disease that results in death in early childhood if it can't be transplanted. And this little boy's mom was pregnant with another baby, and we did some testing to see if the baby she was carrying was affected with the disease. And fortunately, that baby was healthy and turned out also to be a match for her brother. And around the same time, we were doing research into looking at blood stem cells in cord blood, and we realized that cord blood was very enriched for these blood stem cells. And so a group of us got together and really thought about ways we might be able to help this child with his baby sister's cord blood, and ultimately got permission to go ahead with a transplant. And we talked with the family and the little boy, and they all agreed to go ahead. The baby was born, and her cord blood was collected. And then we sent them all to France to a doctor named Elian Gluckman, who had the best experience with that kind of transplant, and she did it. And the transplant was a success, and it paved the way for the whole field. And the little boy is now grown up. He's 30, and he's married, and he's healthy, and his blood is still growing from his baby sister's cord blood.
That just gave me chill bumps.
You know, you just like gave it a whole encapsulation, I think, of some of what we really want to talk about here. You mentioned cord blood and stem cells. If you were talking with someone who, you know, has never heard those terms, how do you describe them and help us understand what they are and why they're so valuable?
So cord blood is the baby's blood left over in the placenta, or the, what people call the afterbirth, after a baby is born. And typically it's discarded as medical waste. And researchers in blood biology realized again in the mid-80s that cord blood had blood stem cells, which are the cells that give rise to your blood factory, which is inside your bone marrow. And they realized that cord blood could contain as many of these cells, if not more, than bone marrow, and could be used for a transplant. And in the early days, after this little boy's transplant, a few other children who happened to have leukemia and a baby brother or sister coming along who was a match had transplants, and it was shown that cord blood caused less complications after the transplant was done than bone marrow, even when your donor was matched. And that gave people the idea that maybe we could bank cord blood and use it for people who didn't have a match in their family. And the field has evolved from there.
And so when you first performed this cord blood donation or were involved in this first child and saving him, was there scrutiny about this because of some of the sort of, people assuming that cord blood and stem cells are the same and, you know, some of the controversy around that?
Sure. You know, to be honest, in those days, things were really less mature than they are today, and people didn't have as much understanding of what stem cells were really about. And but even if you come to today, people mix up the word stem cell to mean many different things. And cord blood cells are not embryonic stem cells. When they're collected, there's no risk to the mother or the baby. In fact, they're collected from material that used to be thrown away in the trash. So you're really recycling a discarded substance that can save a life.
These are not the cells from therapeutic or abortions and the stuff that most people are really thinking that were frozen in time at
right.
one point in time by presidential action.
That's correct. This is blood just left over in the placenta after the baby's born. You know, when the baby's inside the mom and growing, the baby has twice as much blood as it really needs because half is always in the placenta getting cleaned and supplied with oxygen so it can go back to the baby. And then as soon as that umbilical cord is cut when a baby is delivered, that other half of the blood stays inside the placenta and isn't needed by anyone anymore.
And so for my patients who I take care of in the prenatal setting and in the hospital, when they, hopefully we talk about it before the time of delivery, but every woman who comes in is offered the opportunity to give their cord blood to this donation. And a lot of people have a lot of questions about private, saving it for their specific child versus this donation into the public and what's going to happen with it. How do you explain that to listeners about the choice that women and families have to donate their cord blood?
Well, so all moms really have the choice to say what happens to their baby's cord blood. And I'm not sure all moms know that.
Because it would just get thrown away.
Normally, a hospital just throws it away. But the mom has the choice to say, I want it to be used for research, or I want to donate it to a public bank so it can be used by somebody who might need a match for a transplant, or I want to store it for my own family, in which case the family would have to contract with a private cord blood bank that for a fee would store it and save it for their own use. The truth is that today, the way we use cord blood, most cord bloods are used as donations for patients in need of a donor for a transplant. But there is a hope that's not proven yet, but that someday cord blood from yourself might be useful to regenerate organs and tissues that are damaged by disease or by aging. And that's a hope,
wow.
but not a reality yet.
Well, let's talk about the reality. What you've mentioned, Fanconi disease can be treated successfully. What other diseases and things that people might have that people have heard of or not would be eligible?
So the typical reasons that cord blood is used for transplant is as a donor cell to a patient who has leukemia or other blood cancers or what's called bone marrow failure. Some people call that aplastic anemia. Or inherited immune deficiency diseases that babies like the bubble boy are known to have, and certain inherited metabolic diseases that are rare but can be cured with a cord blood or a bone marrow transplant. Also, people with sickle cell anemia or a related disease called thalassemia can be cured with a bone marrow or a cord blood transplant.
This is really quite amazing. If I think back to my own medical school experience, when this was maybe on the horizon but was not part of the established treatment, and to hear today having you talking about diseases that can be treated, maybe cured, how does that feel to be part of something that wasn't there and is now life-saving?
Well, I guess it feels great, but I have to say that it kind of happened rather than was predestined.
What do you mean?
Well, when we first saw that young blood cells and blood stem cells were in cord blood, we really had no idea that they might be useful for transplantation. And really the whole field of using cord blood for transplant was just built gradually on one observation after the next. So first we tried it and it worked. And then we said, well, maybe it doesn't have to come from somebody in your family. It could work in the unrelated donor setting or the public setting, and that fortunately worked, and one thing led to another. But we didn't know from the start that this is where we would land.
We are going to need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue talking with internationally renowned expert physician and chief of the Division of Pediatric Blood and Marrow Transplantation at Duke University, Dr. Joanne Kurtzberg, about the gift of cord blood donation. We look forward to continuing this conversation. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Joanne Kurtzberg, internationally renowned expert, physician, and chief of the Division of Pediatric Blood and Marrow Transplantation at Duke University, about the gift of cord blood donation. And Dr. Kurtzberg, before the break, you were telling us about some of the real miracles and advances that have happened due to realizing that there are these early cells in the placenta and the blood after birth. Used to be thrown away, but now can be used. And I wonder if you could walk us through for our listeners who may be pregnant or may know someone who's pregnant and considering this, what do you tell people about what happens to the placenta and the blood after they donate it?
Okay. So, you know, there's two aspects to answering that question. The first is the technical kind of things that happen to the cord blood. So the cord blood is collected either by the doctor or midwife delivering the baby, or by sometimes a staffed collector who is in a center that's a collection site, like UNC is, right after the baby's born. So typically that's within 5 to 10 minutes of the birth. It takes 5 minutes or so to collect the cord blood. It's just drained through the umbilical vein into a bag with some blood thinner, and then it's taken to the case of North Carolinians, our lab at Duke, at the Carolinas Cord Blood Bank, which is a public cord blood bank. And it's processed and tested and frozen, and then it's stored for future use. The details about the cord blood, particularly the what's called tissue type or HLA type and its blood type, are listed on a national registry called the Be the Match Registry through the National Marrow Donor Program.
Be the Match.
Be the Match.
And we'll put a link up for that on our website. I think I like that.
Yeah. Be the Match.
Yes. Be the Match. Through that computer system, patients from all over the world can search for a donor if they need a match for a transplant. And it's actually quite amazing. There are 23 million adult donors listed on the international registries. Wow. And about 700,000 cord blood units. And the patient's information is just typed in, a button is pushed, and within about 20 or 30 seconds, a split screen comes up and says, here are your possible adult matches or cord blood matches. And cord blood has the advantage of not having to match as closely as bone marrow, so a lot of people who will never find a full match can still use a cord blood donor.
So these are patients with leukemia or patients with blood disorders who themselves are looking, or is their doctor helping them?
Yeah, so it can go both ways. The patient can actually do a preliminary search on them by themselves, but more frequently it's their either oncologist or transplant doctor who does the search.
Wow. I'm thinking back 20 years ago when I first got to North Carolina, and a cousin of mine of blessed memory had leukemia and needed a bone marrow, and there were so few people on the registry, and the registries mm-hmm. didn't communicate, and there was no web
right.
to look things up, and the transformation you describe is really phenomenal.
Yeah.
What do you think the next 20 years in this field that you're helping lead and research, what are we looking at? What are we going to see? What's the research?
Well, so I think the research is very exciting and going to go in several directions. One, I think we're going to get better at doing transplants. It won't be as risky, and it maybe will be done earlier in the course of some of these life-threatening diseases. I also think that stem cells and blood stem cells and cord blood will be used to treat diseases we don't treat today. And by that I mean diseases we're calling the emerging field of regenerative medicine. So perhaps to treat patients who had a stroke to help the brain not have so much damage from the stroke, or a person who's had a heart attack heal the heart. Because there are a lot of properties of these cells that go beyond just growing more blood cells. They can reduce inflammation, and they can help stem cells that are already in your body go to an injured area and repair the area.
So people with liver, early liver failure or cirrhosis or scarring of the liver, the early phases, could it be used for things like that?
Well, possibly. I mean, there's no proof yet today, but yes, there's exciting animal data about liver failure, about diabetes, heart failure, all kinds of diseases in the brain. At Duke, we're doing a study in newborns with birth asphyxia, where they have low oxygen during the birthing process. And we're giving them back actually their own cord blood and showing it helps prevent the damage that otherwise occurs in the brain.
Wow.
So I think we're going to be seeing lots of new emerging areas.
I don't know if it's because I've watched so many futuristic movies and sci-fi stuff, or if it's just because it makes sense. But it sounds plausible that these cells really could help us regenerate organs in the future.
Yeah, they give off special signals that come from being inside the placenta when a baby is being formed. So they're kind of programmed to help organs build and regenerate based on what happens in the fetus.
So when you're currently in your work and you're, you know, encouraging people to donate, I mean, what percentage of mothers will donate cord blood? And then what's the biggest challenge you face?
Well, for cord blood banking, I think there are many, many more moms who want to donate than banks have resources to take donations from.
And also, I wanted to donate, but I had some medical problems and was on some special medicines during mm-hmm. delivery, and they wouldn't let me because of that reason, which I understand. But there may be people who want to who can't.
So there are people who want to and can't. And there also are people who aren't living in areas where donation is possible. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. here in North Carolina, we have this bank at Duke called the Carolinas Cord Blood Bank, but we're able to collect cord blood from moms who deliver at UNC and at Duke and at Rex Hospital and Women's Hospital of Greensboro and a few hospitals in Charlotte. Because we have staff in those hospitals and or the doctors, midwives, and administration of those hospitals have put resources into enabling moms to donate. But there are a lot of moms around the country who are in hospitals that aren't set up as donation centers. I will say we just piloted a kit program for donation where if moms call, they can be qualified as a donor. And if they pass the qualification, then a kit is sent to them. And if their doctor or midwife agrees to do the collection for free, then they can donate to a public bank.
Nice.
Well, and it's not super difficult to learn to collect the cord blood.
That's right.
And so a motivated patient and a willing mm-hmm. provider, it seems like that could really happen.
Yeah, it could totally happen. It does take 5-6 minutes. And sometimes I think if a person is delivering the baby, taking care of the mom, taking care of the baby, and then thinking about collecting the cord blood, the sequencing can be difficult. But in a normal and complicated delivery, it can work.
So you're the medical director and the chief scientific officer of the Carolina Cord Blood Bank. Is this organization working with blood banks around the country? And what does it do for the education of the public? Because it seems like there is a large educational role that people mm-hmm. need to know what this is, how to promote it, how to get more research.
Mm-hmm. So we are part of a national network called the National Cord Blood Inventory, which is part of the CW Bill Young Cell Transplantation Program, which was established with legislation that was passed in 2005. And the whole program is administered under part of HHS called HRSA. But I have to say, I don't think we do the best job advertising the opportunity to donate cord blood because everybody's just busy dealing with the donations that they can get. There's more of a need to get the word out.
Well, you know, we really want to thank you, Dr. Joanne Kurtzberg, Chief of the Division of Pediatric Blood and Marrow Transplantation at Duke University, for really being our guest today and talking to us from a very heartfelt basis about the successes and the future opportunities for this field. Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And I must say, it's really gratifying to see Duke and University of North Carolina joining forces together. The whole is much better than the sum.
Agreed.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the house call segment of our show today, Adam, we get to spend a few minutes talking about our listeners' health questions and concerns.
And Christy, any listener can send a comment or a question to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to read us our first house call question today about diabetes.
I've had diabetes for over 30 years, and it's now under such good control that my doctor stopped my insulin but increased my pill, metformin, from 2 to 3 tablets per day. For the last 3 weeks, I've had diarrhea 5 to 10 times a day. My sugars are still under great control, so I don't think this is related to my diabetes. Will this resolve on its own?
Wow. Well, congratulations for having your diabetes under such good control that you're able to come off the insulin. That's something to really be proud of.
And we suspect that many people who are able to do this, the doctors really work with them on weight loss, or you've worked with your doctor on weight loss, and that's a great thing. But uh-oh, you're not better right now. You're actually probably feeling worse, at least I would be.
So I think it's important to underscore first that metformin is a wonderful medication for diabetes. It's really, it's the thing that helps your body use the insulin that you have. The problem is it can, in some people, and sometimes at just at higher doses, lead to diarrhea and bloating and stomach cramping. And I wonder if that is the culprit here.
Yeah, we certainly would want to probably have you come in, and sometimes we would do a stool analysis. That's like looking at your poop. That's not a fancy term, but it's what we do. And then we also, you know, sometimes would maybe look at some blood, you know, make sure there's not infection. But a common thing is being commonly, we made a change with an increased dose of a medicine. You had a change, the wrong direction here. Stopping that and holding it or cutting back and seeing if it resolves would be one of the first things we would do.
Yep, we certainly hope that you are able to be on medicines that allow you to stay off insulin for a little bit longer and keep losing weight and taking care of your health and in a well-rounded approach. Thanks for sharing. Let's take our next house call question.
I'm 65 years old and went through menopause 10 years ago. My husband and I rarely have sex because it's not comfortable for me and my desire is not high. I've heard about testosterone for men, but what about for women?
I bet you have heard about testosterone for women because it certainly is in the news, and it's a really good question because this is not something that, you know, maybe a lot of doctors are as comfortable talking about because maybe the women don't bring it up as quite as often, but I think it's a great question.
It is a wonderful question, and the truth is a lot of women, a lot of my patients, it's astounding, have this problem either where they want to have sex in their mind, but they really just don't have the desire, or where it's not comfortable and that confuses the situation. It's usually really complex and sometimes related to your body image or what's going on in your marriage or other things that require follow-up with a doctor. So like just a quick prescription usually doesn't do the trick.
And it's important to know that there are many different modalities, ways of treating the issues you describe, including estrogen and estrogen cream, which is sometimes used for that dryness.
Or lubrication.
Lubrication that can help. The desire, there are again other things that can be tried. Testosterone is one of the things that can be tried. It actually has to be specially compounded, made up by a pharmacist to get to the right dose that's recommended. And you certainly would want to do that under a doctor's supervision. You wouldn't want to do this on your own.
We just reviewed some research, I don't know, but maybe a month ago, Adam, about a link between starting testosterone and higher rates of heart attacks in men. This research hasn't been studied in women because it's so uncommonly used, but that would be something you'd want to talk with your doctor about also.
A really good question, and stay tuned. Maybe we'll have more answers as we go along. Erica, what's our very next house call?
My doctor said I have a new problem, diastolic heart failure. I exercise, don't smoke, and am not overweight. I've had high blood pressure for many years, but it's now under control. I had an echocardiogram done 1 month ago, and they said that the heart failure was seen on the echocardiogram. I have no other symptoms. Should I be concerned?
Well, we sometimes, unfortunately, can scare people like yourself when we give them their echocardiogram results, and it says on there, diastolic dysfunction, diastolic heart failure. And it's like, oh my goodness, I know you're going to be concerned, even if I tell you, don't be concerned.
Well, and it is something that you should be at least aware of and somewhat concerned about. What we're talking about is the difference between systolic heart failure, which is when people have problems with the squeeze of their heart not being very strong, and diastolic heart failure, which is when the blood pours into your heart that is just a little more stiff as the blood comes into your ventricle. And that is caused by high blood pressure over years and the situation with you. And the only real thing we have to do for it, especially if you don't have any symptoms, is to keep controlling that blood pressure really well to try to prevent any further damage.
And it sounds like you're probably doing that. The reality is the lower the blood pressure in general, as long as you're not having symptoms from low blood pressure, the better it is. So you could talk with your doctor, ask your doctor, you know, I have this condition, but maybe you're doing everything that you can do, and congratulations. It's great that you're not overweight, don't smoke, and that you exercise. You're probably getting as good a benefit as you can. Thank you for a really good question and one that a lot of people probably have.
You know, let's ask our fantastic health sciences librarians to put up some information on our blog about the difference between systolic and diastolic heart failure.
Great question. Erica, what's our very last house call?
I'm a 50-year-old woman who had a heart attack last year. The doctor recommended exercise, so I started a program with daily workouts with a trainer. I've had pain in my left thigh for 2 months, going from my hip to my knee. I take ibuprofen, but it doesn't help much. I continue to exercise on a treadmill, and my trainer says it will get better with time. I would appreciate your thoughts.
Well, first off, good for you for really getting to do daily workouts with a trainer and really committing to exercise, and then you're continuing to exercise even though it hurts some. That is an empowered woman, and we were just talking about that a couple of weeks ago. And I think that you should feel really proud of yourself for being activated.
You know, I do have some concerns here about the length of time that you've had this pain going on for 2 months. And, you know, one of the first things we really look at is, when did this start? Did it start when you actually started exercising more? Because you can get things that may not get better with time if you don't alter what you do. Like if you had a stress fracture or if you had a inflammation of the muscle related to the amount of physical activity you're doing, you might have to alter what you do temporarily.
Or sometimes related to either arthritis or related to inflammation in that outer part of your thigh called the IT band, you can get some pain right there that can go away with maybe rolling it out. Well, let's put up some exercise about using a foam roller on the side of your leg. We'll do that to our blog. But taking ibuprofen can help. And sometimes altering your exercise but continuing to move can really help the pain kind of lighten up over time.
Yeah, I would probably advise that you see a physical therapist in addition to your trainer, maybe a doctor, maybe an orthopedist, and maybe cut back for 2 weeks on the treadmill and see what happens. Well, that'll conclude our house calls today, Christy. We've had a great chance to talk about diabetes and metformin.
To talk about heart failure and the different types.
About menopause and sexual desire among postmenopausal women.
And about medications for diabetes, some that can cause you to have a little stomach upset.
Well, thank you for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to you. You can email us your own questions at yourhealth@unc.edu and visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or join our health app by searching on iTunes for Your Health, one word, for a free download.
We want to thank the Department of Family Medicine at UNC, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Joanne Kurtzberg. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.